So speaking of Cambridge, I'd like to introduce our next speaker, John Balduck. John is an environmental planner with the City of Cambridge in their Community Development Department, where he manages the city's climate change vulnerability assessment and the climate change preparedness and resilience plan. He also coordinates the city's Climate Protection Action Committee, which is an advisory group to the city manager on local climate change policy and implementation. He administers the Building Energy Use Disclosure Ordinance and participates in a range of other municipal sustainability efforts. So in summary, John is a busy guy. John, please tell us about how you have approached this topic in the City of Cambridge. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks, Victoria, and I assume everyone can see the slides. So hello, everybody. I'm going to talk about our vulnerability assessment and preparedness planning work in Cambridge, focusing on risks from heat. We're also doing a lot of work on precipitation flooding and storm surge flooding. It's kind of difficult to cover everything about our work on heat, but I'll try to give you a sense of the range of activities that we've conducted to date. In our part of the country, high temperatures have not been a big concern historically. In New England, we're obviously a cold weather climate. But we observe that temperatures are rising, and projections based on climate science indicate that by 2030, we may see a near tripling of days over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, going from about 11 days per year to over 30 days. And by 2070, we could see 4 to 6 times more days over 90 degrees, and a significant number of days over 100 degrees, which is currently a rare event. To provide a sense of what these changes mean, the chart that you see illustrates the proportion of the 3 summer months that will experience 90-plus degree days. So you can see an increasing amount of our summers will be quite warm, which would be a very different kind of climate than we're used to. So in addition to extreme hot days becoming a risk, we can expect more of these hot days will string together as heat waves, and that heat waves will be longer in duration. And as a very dense urban community, the heat island effect exacerbates these temperature risks. So given that extreme heat, more heat waves, and long heat waves are coming our way, the city wanted to understand its physical and social vulnerabilities to increasing heat if no changes are made, and develop a better understanding of how our particular urban form influences temperatures and how it could be modified to reduce the urban heat island effect. The city can't directly change temperature trends, but the city can adapt its built environment and people. So to understand our vulnerability to heat, the city needs to understand both temperature trends and the local heat island effect. Since we don't have a good network of ground level temperature sensors, the city's consultants at Kleinfelder developed an approach using satellite data. The consultants recommended using Landsat data to provide surface temperature data. Landsat was chosen because the resolution provided enough detail, given that Cambridge is very small geographically. We're only about 6.25 square miles. MODIS was the other type of satellite data considered. The resolution of MODIS data versus Landsat is about 250 meters versus 30 meters, so you can see a big difference. Another disadvantage of MODIS data is that it has an issue with cloud mass, so on a single day, land surface temperature cannot be used, and rather multiple days or weeks need to be used to extract the maximum or minimum value of each pixel to avoid the cloud problem. However, MODIS has better temporal resolution compared to Landsat, daily versus 16-day repeat cycle, which enables nighttime temperatures to be studied. So I think which data you choose depends on the scale of study and the study objectives. For the purposes of our vulnerability assessment, we wanted to work with air temperatures. I won't go through all the steps that are shown in this chart, but the Landsat data was processed to estimate ambient air temperature about 6 feet off the ground. They also factored in humidity to estimate the heat index temperatures, which is important to understanding human health risks. We related the projected temperatures to the NOAA heat index, which you might be familiar with, and this shows the likelihood of human health heat disorders with prolonged exposure or strenuous activity relative to temperatures both for ambient and heat index. With the Landsat data, the consultants produced heat island maps for present day 2030 and 2070. On this map, which is based on a day that was 83 degrees Fahrenheit, there were not areas that fall within NOAA's dangerous category at which people would see more heat exhaustion and possibly heat stroke. And for 2030, we assumed no changes in the city and assumed a 90 degree day, which we project to have many more of by that year. We could also see this pattern today on a 90 degree day. The map doesn't show any dangerous spots, but the area of extreme caution expands significantly. And then for 2070, we assumed a 100 degree day, which could happen today, but is very rare here. And you see the emergence of dangerous zones throughout the city, which are the red areas. So in contrast to the previous maps based on ambient air temperature, we also produced a series of maps based on heat index temperatures that factor in humidity. This would be the feels like temperature to a person. Humidity levels of 50 to 55% were assumed, which is common here, with a 90 degree day. With heat index temperatures, we see hot spots by 2030. So we used the heat island maps first to identify the city's physical and social vulnerabilities by overlaying the heat islands with maps of physical assets such as key infrastructure and critical facilities and demographic data. With this analysis, we identified specific assets that might be at risk from high heat, such as electric substations and neighborhoods with greater proportions of people with risk factors for heat, such as age. The assets and areas were rated for vulnerability and risk, and these findings are being used to identify priorities for our preparedness and resilience planning. Cambridge is using the vulnerability assessment to inform the climate change preparedness and resilience plan. Our strategies are falling into four main buckets. I will focus on the last one for resilient ecosystems, which covers green infrastructure and urban forests. So we have a good sense of the types of strategies that can help offset some of the impact of rising temperatures, but the city wanted to understand how much an effect these strategies could have in Cambridge and where they should best be deployed. So the consultants figured out an approach to take the heat island data and join it with other data to assess the effectiveness of converting impervious surfaces to vegetation, converting more building roofs to white roofs, expanding the urban forest canopy. The heat island maps are redrawn to show temperatures in 5-degree intervals to provide more geographic resolution. On this map, hot spots, which would see 95 degrees or higher on a 90 degree day, are identified around the city. Then we brought in tree canopy data. The University of Vermont Spatial Analysis Lab, who are experts on urban forest canopy assessment, and who I recommend contacting if you want to map your tree canopy, produced Cambridge's first tree canopy map in 2012 based on 2009 LIDAR data. The UVM assessment measured the tree canopy at 30% of Cambridge's land area and estimated we have a technical potential to expand the canopy by an additional 35% for our 65% maximum. For various reasons, we can't achieve the full 65%, but we should be able to expand somewhere in between. So our consultants took this data, which has very high resolution, and divided it into a grid of 100 by 100 foot cells across the city, and then calculated the tree canopy cover for each cell. And a relationship was developed showing a 1% tree canopy increase relates to a 0.12 degree Fahrenheit cooling effect based on our data. So with that relationship of tree canopy to cooling effect, a tree canopy cooling effect map was developed. So to understand the potential cooling effect of expanding the tree canopy, we tested different scenarios of tree canopy expansion by modifying the tree canopy map grid, then calculating the cooling effect in each of the grid cells. So the first map is the baseline showing 2030 conditions or a 90 degree day with our current tree canopy coverage. And this map tests what happens if tree canopy is increased by 30% citywide, meaning that existing canopy in every cell in the grid expands by 30%. This is approaching the technical maximum, which is probably not possible. And in some cells, it's probably not even technically possible because the tree canopy coverage is already high. But you see a cooling effect on the maps compared to the baseline map. So in this map, tests a targeted approach where only the cells that have 30% or less in tree canopy cover are increased by 30%. So you see a similar cooling effect in terms of knocking down the dangerous hot spots, but less effect between hot spots. And then this map shows an even more targeted approach where the map cells with 15% or less in tree canopy cover are increased by 40%. So I think these tests suggest that a targeted approach could make sense if resources are limited. But it also suggests a significant effort to expand tree canopy is needed to see a cooling effect in the face of rising temperatures. I also wanted to mention the consultants looked at tree canopy from a street design point of view to provide a sense of the density of tree canopy cover associated with cooler temperatures. So they found a relationship between street tree count and tree canopy cooling effect, which was that for each tree, there was a 1 degree of cooling per 100 feet, or basically it would be 1 degree between two trees 100 feet apart. So we also looked at how converting impervious surfaces to vegetation and how that could provide cooling. And on the picture, you're seeing a area of the Alewife neighborhood in Cambridge. It's in the northwestern corner of the city, which is highly impervious. It's a light industrial area with also some new high-density residential being built. So we want to take a look at that kind of area to see how we could modify the environment there. So the consultants identified a relationship that found for every 10% decrease in impervious area, there was a 1 degree decrease in temperature. At lower levels of impervious area, this relationship wasn't as strong. So this analysis focused on one part of the city known as Alewife, which, as I mentioned, is in the northwestern corner of Cambridge. The analysis was based on storm drainage subcatchment areas because there are other benefits to green infrastructure, such as reducing runoff and reducing nutrient loading to waterways, which we are also trying to capture along with heat island reduction. So the result, the consultants applied green infrastructure measures such as bioretention basins, porous pavement, and green roofs at a maximum extent practicable rate to each parcel in the subcatchment area to estimate how much the impervious areas could be reduced, and then calculated the cooling effect based on the 10% one degree relationship. So we see this cooling effect here, which is an average across the area of about 1.7 degrees Fahrenheit. This was also done with white roofs, assuming that 50% of existing building roofs are white. This yielded an average cooling effect of 2.4 degrees. Now, I would say we are not certain what effect cool roofs have on street level temperatures. So this is all still work in progress, and we also don't want to overstate the precision. The city is basically trying to get a handle on the level of effort that will be required with different strategies to achieve a cooling effect so that we can deploy our resources efficiently and smartly. So on the slide, we're summarizing what I mentioned already in terms of the effect of these different measures and their ability to cool areas. So another aspect we are working on is to understand how to deploy urban forest canopy and green infrastructure strategies in combination and how much effect they have together. This graphic shows a light industrial dense multifamily residential area of the Alewife neighborhood that's mostly impervious. So we want to ask ourselves what can be done to cool this area by modifying it with ground vegetation and trees. So our next steps are to try to do that combined analysis to see the effect of mixing these tactics. And I think also think about the analysis and the indication that targeting our efforts makes sense at a neighborhood scale rather than trying to set citywide goals. So, you know, for instance, instead of setting a citywide tree canopy expansion goal, maybe it makes more sense to set goals at the neighborhood scale and target those neighborhoods that really need it. I think this is something we still need to discuss with the community, but I think the analysis suggests this might be a fruitful way to go. We also need to understand night temperatures. The Landsat data couldn't provide that for us, and we understand the importance of knowing what happens with night temperatures, especially relative to human health. We're also interested in taking a look at the regional effects. So, you know, Cambridge is very small, and often when you look at heat island analyses, they're done at a much larger sort of metropolitan scale. So in the Boston area, we have a regional climate change collaboration involving 14 cities and towns centered around Boston, working through our regional planning agency. And we're all trying to work together on resilience measures as well as greenhouse gas mitigation measures. And so all of those communities are just about to get the same kind of tree canopy data that we have from the University of Vermont. So I think there's an opportunity to take a regional look at this. We do have some regional data based on MODIS from the Trust for Public Land, which has built a tool under their Climate Smart Cities program that has some interesting results and patterns, but I think we need more resolution. So I think we'd like to work on that side. And then we would like to do, I think, what Baltimore is doing in terms of trying to build a ground-mounted temperature humidity sensor network. And we're having some discussions with local researchers about trying to set that up. So that's the Cambridge story, and here's our contact information. So my contact information, our project website link, and then the contact information for our consultants. So thank you very much.
Thank you, John, for that great presentation. It's obvious that you all have been very thorough and deliberative about your work, and you have thought about many of the considerations that Dave mentioned in his presentation. So I commend you, and it also sounds like you have the work has generated some ideas for next steps and mitigation measures that you can take to reduce the urban heat. So we look forward to continuing to hear how you guys progress. So we're going to do another poll question to get everyone involved. Just take about a minute or two to select one. Again, I know it's not easy, but try to do your best. Which of the following best characterizes your community's current efforts to reduce urban heat? Are you just beginning to talk about it? Are you in the process of actually analyzing your heat island? Are you advanced to the stage where you are developing a heat mitigation action plan? And or have you started actually implementing projects and programs? Or you haven't started at all talking about the heat island. So just take about a minute, and then Brad will read the answers.
Okay, we have some answers here. It looks like the majority was just beginning to talk about it, followed by in the process of analyzing the heat island, or heat islands, I should say, and then implementing heat island mitigation projects or programs, and 16% haven't started yet, and then 9% are actually developing a mitigation action plan.
Thanks, Brad. This is really good information for us. If you want to reach out and let me know about your exact actions, that would be great. And if EPA can help or any of the speakers in your efforts, please let us know.